हरे कृष्णा
हरे कृष्णा।
ओम ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानाञ्जनशलाकाय चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। हरे कृष्णा
हरे कृष्णा।
सो वी कंटिन्यू आवर डिस्कशन ऑन द मार्किने भागवत धर्म। वी डिस्कस थ्री स्टैंजर्स इन द मॉर्निंग। द फर्स्ट वाज माय डियर लॉर्ड, थैंक यू फॉर गेटिंग मी हियर। Second was, now whatever is your purpose, let it be fulfilled. Otherwise, you must have some purpose. Why would you get me here? And third text was that people here are covered over by the modes. How will they understand your sacred message? How will they understand the rasa of bhakti? So here he states now that if you bestow your causeless mercy, everything will come within the realm of possibility. Within possibility. So, sabkala is sambhav hoy. That everything is possible with God. Now, this is a theme which is often talked about in... Okay. So, okay. Everything is possible with Krishna, with God. That is the common theme in religious literature. So I'll talk about two related terms here: miracles and mercy. Often we use the word miraculous mercy or a merciful miracle also sometimes. But how are the two words related? Usually when the word miracle is used, it can mean many things, but it is usually used to refer to something which contradicts the laws of nature. So for example, it is said that Jesus parted the sea, that God parted the seas for the Jews, for the followers of Moses when they were escaping from Egypt. Or Krishna lifted Govardhan Hill. So these are miracles where the normal laws of nature are suspended. And people who are rationalists often say that the miracles are impossible. They can't happen. The laws of nature are what is real. Yes, they are real. But you have to understand, the laws of nature are not essential for nature. In the sense that, say, E is equal to mc square, or F is equal to mg1 into 1 r square. Is a law of gravity or law Einstein's matter, right, conversion, whatever. Now it could very well be that it could be E is equal to mc cube. It's not like that, but there's no reason why it had to be mc square only. So nature's are laws, they are observed patterns in nature. They are not intrinsic necessities in nature. Nature could have arranged itself in some other way also. So, a simple example to illustrate this is that suppose there is a poultry farm and there is some hen and some cock over there, and there is the poultry farmer's wife. Every morning she comes at 6 o'clock and puts some grains for all the hen and the cocks. And then this Mr. Cock, he observes, and he sees every day at 6 a.m. sharp, the door opens and food comes in. And he says, it is a law of nature that at 6 o'clock, the cage door opens and food comes in. How? Everybody else says, oh, you're so brilliant. Yes, it is a law of nature. Every day it is happening. And then they start doing observations further. He says, yes, it's happening. It's correct law of nature. So Mr. Cock gets a Nobel Prize. And then one day, the door opens. And instead of the grains coming in, a hand comes in, grabs the cock and takes him to the kitchen. So there are definitely patterns in nature, but those patterns in nature, why do they have to be present at all? So yes, there are patterns in nature, but there is something beyond nature. So when we talk about miracles are not against nature. They are above nature. They are not against science. They are above science. Science basically observes the patterns in nature. And yes, we agree that the patterns are there. But what we also say is that these patterns, they don't have to be necessarily present. They are present, and they are present by the will of a personal controller. And sometimes that personal controller can suspend those patterns. So if somebody asks, when Krishna lifted the Govardhan Hill, you know, how did he find the center of gravity? To put his finger exactly at the center of gravity so that he could balance Govardhan Hill. Now Krishna doesn't have to find the center of gravity because he is the source of gravity. So he can, by his will, Mayadhyakshena Prakriti Suyate Sacharacharam. By his will, the laws of nature work, and by his will, the laws of nature can also be suspended. Now, miracles, when they are used in this sense, they are special occasions when the laws of nature are suspended. Now, some people argue, you know, in the past, people were superstitious, just believed some fairy tales. Anybody spun some tales and they were believed. But it's not like that. We see that even after the Govardhan Leela, the Vrajavasis go and ask Nanda Maharaj, now how was such a small boy, Krishna, able to lift such a big mountain? That means they also had observed some orderly patterns in nature, and they know that a small boy cannot lift such a mountain. That means it is not that they just believed it, they also asked a question. But their difference from the modern rationalist attitude is, they were open to another level of explanation. So when they got the explanation that, yes, Gargamuni said that Krishna is almost like Narayana. He has been blessed by Narayana. So then they, oh yes, then it's possible. So they accepted that there are patterns in nature, but there are higher beings which can alter the patterns of nature. So this is the way in which normally the word miracles are used. Now when we use the word mercy, it is more in a personal sense. Miracle is more in a sense of something astonishing happening in the natural world. The word mercy is used more in a personal sense that God is merciful. That person so and so is very merciful. It's more a directly personal describer. Now of course, in philosophy of language, there is a big debate where exactly are the meanings of words stored. I may use a particular word. I gave a class in London, and after that one devotee came and he said, Prabhu, you killed it. I wonder, did I kill a mosquito or what did I kill? So you killed it is actually a way of appreciating. As you see, in the past people would go on hunting and you would kill it. You killed it, congratulations. So it is like that. Now, so the meanings of the words, are they stored in dictionaries or are they stored in people's minds? So actually it's a combination of both. So miracle and mercy, the words can be used in different contexts. I'm just talking about two distinct concepts over here. So now, generally, if in our context, the word for miracle is chamatkar. And for mercy is krupa or karuna. So in bhakti, we don't use the word chamatkar so much. We use it, but much more is krupa or mercy. So now when we talk about mercy can happen in natural ways also. So Hanuman flew to Lanka. Srila Prabhupada went by ship to Jaladutta to America. You know, Prabhupada's journey might not have been as miraculous as Hanuman's. But Prabhupada's purpose was similar. And Prabhupada was just as empowered by the Lord's mercy in his own way as was Hanuman. So when mercy happens, it can happen. Mercy can come in natural ways also. That means in Srila Prabhupada's life, there is miracles in terms of supernatural phenomena. Prabhupada did not stress that very much. Prabhupada did not give much credence to that because he said this is all possible by mystic siddhis. But so Prabhupada is asking for krupa. Now what is the mercy that he is asking for? That mercy is, well, that actually in the previous verse he said, how will they understand your message, O Lord? So he's saying, by your mercy, everything is possible. That means, by your mercy, even these people can understand your message. So in bhakti, we don't just believe in miracles, we depend on miracles. Prabhupada would say, we want to shoot the rhino. So Prabhupada wanted to do big, big things. And Krishna arranged in miraculous ways to provide help. So it was that a devotee tries to do something big for Krishna's sake. And then, at that time when the devotee tries sincerely to serve Krishna, Krishna sees the sincerity and Krishna empowers the devotee. So when we try to serve Krishna, sometimes we may feel that I don't have the abilities to do this. Yes, it may well be possible, but when we feel something is impossible, as devotees we focus not so much on what we can do and what we can't do. We focus on what Krishna can do. And he, for him actually nothing is impossible. When Jayadrath treacherously arranged for Abhimanyu to be trapped, and then Abhimanyu was slain, so Arjuna took a fierce vow. By the next evening, either I'll kill Jayadrath or I will enter into fire. And the Pandavas, who had been very depressed, they became jubilant and started celebrating. Arjuna's vow means tomorrow will be the worst day for the Kauravas. Now, after the plans were made and Krishna and Arjuna were going, so at that time Krishna told Arjuna, you took a very hasty vow. Should have consulted me first. Tomorrow Drona will arrange the whole army to stop you. For you to reach Jayadrath will be extremely difficult. So Arjuna very nonchalantly said, Krishna, I can't understand why you are worried. He says, you know my power and I know your power.
So,
actually, a devotee's faith comes not just by one's own power. Do we need it? Am I audible behind? We can keep it. Right. Okay. So, a devotee's faith. So a devotee's faith is based not just on one's own power. It is based on Krishna's omnipotence. Now, Krishna can act in various ways. Krishna can act for us and Krishna can act through us. Both are empowerments. Act for us means that sometimes we are trying to persuade someone to do something. And it's very important that the person do it, but the person is not listening only. And we pray to Krishna and then, the next day we meet that person, the person is completely different mood. Yes, let's do it together. So Krishna acted for us. Sometimes Krishna can act for us in his own ways directly. Sometimes Krishna can act through us. Sometimes we want to speak something and suddenly the points, the ideas, the logic, the plan comes and we speak it and the person is won over. So the point is that empowerment can happen in different ways. So Krishna can act for us and Krishna can act through us. So as devotees, we focus... Am I audible behind? Okay. That's okay. But if you're audible, then there's no problem. So if we focus on this principle that Krishna is our Lord and that He is omnipotent. Now, this does not necessarily mean that we foolishly run into dangers. No, our purpose is to serve Krishna. And while serving Krishna, for His service, if we have to take up something which is very difficult for us, we try it. It is not necessary that Krishna will always empower us to do that which is not possible for us. And sometimes we may try something, it may not work out. But that doesn't mean that that Krishna doesn't care for us. It is just that Krishna may be planning to use different agents at different times. So sometimes we may strive to do something difficult, it may not work out. But what matters is our intention. If we tried sincerely, then that itself is success. So as devotees, when we try, Prabhupada, he could very easily have said, these people, they are not going to understand Krishna's message. He said, no, Krishna, you can make them understand. You can make them understand. And with this faith, he perseveres. So now what that specific prayer that he can, that you can make them understand your message, that he will speak in the next verse. Can you recite this verse and the next again?
The same verse again.
Same verse and then go to the next verse.
So together.
Together, yeah. Sorry, I forgot to move it forward. So how will they ever understand the rasa of bhakti? Oh Lord, oh Master, it can happen only by your mercy. So, ki bhave bujhale tar, bujhe se rasa. Now, how will they understand the rasa of bhakti? That is the question he is asking. Now, we use the word rasa very commonly in our discussions about what we call bhakti rasa. Bhakti rasa Amrit Sindhu is a book that Srila Rupa Goswami has written. The word rasa originally comes from Natya Shastra. In Natya Shastra, which is written by Bharat Muni, it is described that rasa is what, if a drama is performed very well, then the emotion that the audience experiences is called rasa. So, to experience rasa, one needs to be a rasika. What does this mean? Say, suppose somebody is performing a Bharatanatyam dance. Now, the dance itself may be attractive to see. But it's not just attractive, it's meaningful. Now, through the hand gestures, through the facial expressions, through the bodily movements, something is being conveyed. And to understand that, one needs to have prior knowledge of the pastime. Without prior knowledge of that pastime, one cannot understand what is being depicted. One will think, okay, this is just a good dance. But when one knows the pastime, one can say, it's not just a good dance, it's a meaningful dance. Something meaningful is conveyed to it, through it. So, rasika, a rasika audience is that audience which knows the pastime. This is an example given, that they have to have some prior understanding by which they can appreciate what is being described. The same concept is applied by Vishwanath Chakra Thakur when he explains Srimad Bhagavatam 8.36, that's a prayer by Gajendra, and he says, Naryasya deva rushaya padam vidur janta jantu puna ko arhati gantu miritu yathanatasya kruti bir vicheshtito durattaya anukramana samavatu. He says that, my dear Lord, even the devata, the rishis and the devatas cannot understand you. Janto puna ko arhati. Then how can an animal like me understand? And then he gives the yatha natasya akruti bhir vicheshtito. A nutter, actor, akruti, the nutter does various gestures. Vicheshtito, does various gestures. But a person who is ignorant cannot understand this. Durattaya anukramana. So similarly, my dear Lord, your pastimes are difficult to understand. Samavatu, I simply surrender to you. So when we hear Krishna's message, a person has to be at a particular level to appreciate Krishna Lila. If one is not at a particular spiritual level, particular cultural level, particular intellectual level, then they just don't find it relevant. Now, of course, this does not mean that people are meant to be deprived. Then it becomes the expertise of the preacher, that the bhakti rasa should be made accessible to people where they are at. But at the same time, that extension is not necessarily bhakti rasa. Sometimes some preachers may use a lot of humor. Some people may quote a lot of contemporary statistics. Some preachers may use a lot of contemporary anecdotes. We may all use different things to connect with people, and that is important. So basically, if we see when we are trying to share Krishna message, what is happening? Krishna is here, we are here, and the audience is here. Now we want to connect the audience with Krishna. So now, for this, whatever we are presenting, we have to make it relevant to the audience. So Prabhupada says, realization means to present things in a way that is interesting to the audience. How does one get this realization? That means one understands Krishna's message, one understands the audience level, and then one presents. So if the audience is completely not at the level to understand that message. So for example, if there is a Nobel laureate mathematician who has done some path-breaking work in triple integral calculus. And if that mathematician is asked to speak to kindergarten children, now that mathematician will actually have to dumb down the presentation. He can speak so much more. But at that point, if the mathematician speaks triple integral calculus, that's of no use to the kids. So it is said that in preaching, the point is not just to get it right. The point is to get it across. The point is to get it across. I may speak everything right, but if the audience doesn't connect with it, then there is not much point that is served by it. So Prabhupada is contemplating here that it's going to be difficult for people to connect. So Prabhupada himself will see that he was very expert in connecting with people. But here he's saying, Krishna, it's only by your mercy it's possible. So I earlier talked about the modes basically, as I said, they shape the interaction between consciousness and matter. And they filter our perception of everything. So when we are in the mode of passion, things which provide some immediate pleasure, that is what interests us. The philosophy, come on, forget it. It's not for me. You know, I may be interested in philosophy if I can go next to a party and impress people with how much philosophy I know. But I am not interested in philosophy per se. If it can promote me in my whatever purposes I have, then I am interested in it. Otherwise, nothing doing. So what happens is our scope of interest is shaped by our level of consciousness. So our scope of interest is shaped by our level of consciousness. And the mode of passion and ignorance, it takes us down to a very low level of consciousness. And therefore, the scope of interest also becomes limited by that low level of consciousness. So Prabhupada, for him the challenge was, how do you present to people? Once the devotees just wanted to please Srila Prabhupada, and they went to a nearby market and they saw some Indian looking art and they brought it. And there was a picture of Hanuman with it. They didn't know who it was. Prabhupada saw it and folded his hands. And he said, Swamiji, who is this? Is this looking like a cat? They thought of Hanuman to be a cat. They had absolutely no knowledge. So the level they were at was so different that actually to present things at that level becomes very difficult. So what Prabhupada is saying over here is actually, Krishna, that it is only by your mercy that they will be able to understand this. Ki bhave bujhale tara bujhe se iras. How will they understand it? But you kautuki, you are a supreme mystic, O Lord, you can do anything. So by your mercy it is possible. And here we see in this prayer, there is a mood of Prabhupada's dependence on Krishna. We'll see when he was speaking, when he was talking with people, there was complete diligence. He was doing everything as well as he could. But there, when he's in prayerful mood, it's complete dependence. Krishna, you do it. And in this way, what is being demonstrated is, Prabhupada is not thinking that, you know, I am a preacher and I am going to go and make the whole world Krishna conscious. Prabhupada is thinking that, Krishna, only you can do it. So his focus is always on Krishna. And now, when you talk about mercy, there is one interesting feature about mercy. Krishna's mercy is reciprocal, but not necessarily proportional. What does that mean? That means that when we turn towards Krishna, Krishna reciprocates. But you know, how much he reciprocates does not necessarily depend on how much efforts we make. Why? Because Krishna is free. He is supremely independent. He is Swaraj. So in the Bible, there is a story that illustrates this. I'll tell that, and I'll tell some similar Vedic concepts after that. So the story is, there was a landlord. He saw that there were some people who were looking very forlorn. He had gone to the market. And they were looking very sad. He said, you know, we asked, what happened? He says, we don't have any money. We don't know what we will eat. He says, I've got a big field. If you come and work there, I will pay you what is right. They all came there. And they started working. And then, in the afternoon, they work for, since the morning they started working, in the afternoon, some more people came there. He says, you know, we also need some food. Can we do some work? He says, you also work here. And some people came just in the late afternoon. And they also worked over there. And then, when the time of payment came, the landlord paid everyone the equal money. They all protested, what is this? You know, we worked since morning. And this person just worked for a couple of hours. So the landlord said that, you know, I said, I will pay you what is right. So whatever is your need, I am paying all of you that. So Jesus tells the story to his disciples. And he is especially telling it, at that time when Jesus came, actually Jesus came in a Jewish culture. And he was himself a Jew. He never said that I am starting a new religion called Christianity. But so at that time they had become very, what in our language we call smart. Not smart, smarter. So they had become very ritualistic. You know, okay, if you do this ritual this many times, then you will get this result. So they had made almost religion into like a mathematical affair. So Jesus said, no, God's mercy is independent. This is how God bestows his mercy. So someone may practice bhakti at the age of 20 and lifelong they practice bhakti. And they may remember Krishna at the moment of death and they may go to Krishna. Somebody may start practicing bhakti at the age of 60. And they may also remember Krishna and they may go to Krishna also. You see, you know, I resisted temptation for 60 years. This person only for 20 years. No, it's not like that. It's Krishna's mercy. He is Swaraj. He can give his mercy to anyone. That does not mean that it is arbitrary. See, arbitrary means there is no rhyme and reason for it. Krishna's mercy is based on sincerity. So, sincerity can also be seen through the duration for which one is practicing bhakti. But it is not necessarily so. Now, in this context, the point which we are making is that when Prabhupada is going to America, he is at one level seeing that these people, they are so irreligious, they are covered by the modes of passion and ignorance. And as compared to that, Prabhupada was in Vrindavan, and there were so many people who were living very pious lives. And yet, those pious people, Prabhupada preached in India for almost 30-40 years. But it is not that many people actually came forward to assist him. So they had the opportunity, but they did not take the opportunity. See that, you know, we practice religion at our level. Yes, they practiced. But that religion was not so much of committed practice in terms of sadhana bhakti. So, Krishna can bestow his mercy on anyone. And Prabhupada has this faith that these people may be completely unqualified. But Krishna's mercy is not based on anyone's qualification. Yeah. No one can ever qualify oneself for mercy. We do endeavor, we do practice, we do pray. But it is not that our endeavor, our prayer that qualifies us. It is, we do it as a service to Krishna. And when Krishna wants, he gives his mercy. So, materially somebody may be less qualified, somebody more qualified. Religiously somebody may be less qualified, somebody more qualified. And that doesn't matter so much. What matters is whether one is receptive to Krishna. Our receptivity is what enables us to access Krishna. So, Now, one more point here before I move back. I think when we talk about mercy being reciprocal but not proportional, this should not be taken in a negative sense. It's not like sometimes some wealthy people are miserly and just hoard it, and they want people to come and beg 10 times, 100 times, 500 times, and afterward they will give something. So Krishna is not that like miserly about his mercy. It is not that Krishna is miserly and is holding his mercy, not wanting to give it to anyone. No, mercy comes in different installments. And the very opportunity to practice bhakti is mercy. Getting taste in bhakti is a greater mercy. Developing love for Krishna is an even greater mercy. But mercy is not like a digital logic that you have it or you don't have it. It's not like that. Everybody who is practicing bhakti, they have mercy. So rather than worrying about the mercy that we don't have, we work with the mercy that we do have right now. So rather than thinking that, oh, I don't have taste for the holy name, I don't have the taste for this, I can't do this. But the very fact that we are able to practice bhakti, that itself is mercy. Brahmanda Brahmite Kona Bhagyamana Jiyu Guru Krishna Prasade Paye Bhakti Lata Beej. So just getting the Bhakti Lata Beej is also mercy. And mercy is actually very mysterious, in the sense that how it will come on whom, we don't know. But the important thing is, it is not that Krishna is holding the mercy back. Krishna wants us to come to him. Prabhupada writes in the first canto purport, Krishna wants us to come to him more than what we want to go to him also. But the thing is that Krishna wants to see our desire. And to the extent we cherish what we have, Krishna will give us more and more. So we should never feel that, oh, Krishna is not giving me his mercy. No, we are already practicing bhakti. That itself means we have got mercy. So we, as devotees, we are grateful for the mercy that we have. And we use that mercy to serve Krishna according to our capacity. Okay, so we'll recite the same verse again and then go to the next verse. Illusion, by that same will, from illusion they all can gain liberation. Tomara ichhaya sab hoy maya vash. By your will. Now this can seem a little philosophically provocative. Is it that Krishna has put everyone in illusion? Is it that Krishna will in future will that we will come out of illusion? Krishna is not willing right now that we will come out of illusion. So tomara ichhaya, what does it actually mean? This context. So, this is a personal prayer that Srila Prabhupada is offering. And if you look at the whole mood, Prabhupada is not giving an elaborate exposition on Vaishnava Siddhanta. He's offering his prayer to Krishna. He's expressing his heart. And when he is saying Tomara Ichchaya, one factor is of course that, what about the living entity's free will? But Prabhupada is right now, he is not talking with those living entities. When he will talk with them, when he will talk with those people, he will try to persuade them to the best of his capacity. Here, he is offering his prayer to his Lord. So here, when he is talking with Krishna, he is saying, Krishna, I can do it. It is only by your will it is possible. So this is an expression of his dependence in Krishna. He is not thinking that, I am the doer or I am the deliverer. He is thinking, Krishna, you are. So by your will it will happen. Tomara ichchaya. And a devotee's mood is always that actually when Krishna wills, it will happen. Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur, whenever he would make a plan, he says, Krishna willing, he will do it. That means that a devotee makes plans. A devotee also knows that in mathematics or in computer programming, you have something called wild cards. That wild card, when it comes in, it can change everything. One wild card. So, Krishna is like the wild card in all our plans. We make our plans, but Krishna has to sanction those plans. So Prabhupada is focusing here on Krishna entirely. Prabhupada is going to endeavor, and he has endeavored to come to America, but here, tomara ichaya. It is by your will it will happen. Now, the concept of Krishna's sanctioning is also very interesting to understand. There is Krishna's will and Krishna's sanction. And it is, sometimes people ask, if God is omnipotent, if God is all-powerful, then how do we have free will? If God is the supreme controller of everything, then if He controls all of us also, then how do we have free will? So actually, Krishna is the supreme controller. So everything happens by His will. But by His will, He has given us will. By His will, He has given us free will. And by His will, He has given us scope to execute that free will. And that scope in Sankhya is called as Kshetra. The 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, one of the questions Arjuna asks, Kshetra and Kshetrajna, what are they? So Prakriti is general material nature. Whole material existence can be called as Prakriti. Kshetra refers to that area within Prakriti over which a particular soul has control. So an elephant has a huge body as a Kshetra. An ant has a tiny body as a Kshetra. In human beings, our Kshetra is determined not just by the size of our body, that is one factor, but also by our intelligence, our talents, our various abilities. So these are our Kshetra. So our free will exists by Krishna's free will. So our free will exists by Krishna's free will, and the arena for executing our free will also exists by Krishna's free will. So Krishna has given it to us. Now among the two, our free will Krishna never takes away. No matter whatever happens, we always have free will. But depending on how much we use it or how we use it, the scope of the free will can increase or decrease. An alcoholic, a person who's been drinking again and again and again, does an alcoholic have free will? Alcoholic has free will whether to drink beer or whiskey. They may not have free will whether to drink or not. At that level. So, when we use our free will in a particular way, it becomes conditioned. So then, by the use of our free will scope can expand or it can contract. So, in addicted people, the scope of free will has contracted. Even in animals, the scope of free will has contracted. That animals largely behave as per their instincts. A cow sees grass, it will just start chewing the grass. But still, there also it has some free will. Now, if it finishes eating grass in one row, whether it will eat the grass on the left or on the right. That is its free will. So, always we have free will. But based on how we use our free will, the scope for using that free will can increase or decrease. And Krishna doesn't take this free will away, ever. So, Krishna, we see in the Mahabharata, he goes as Shanti Dut to pursue a Duryodhana, to accept the peace proposal. And it's amazing that Krishna fails. Now, can God fail? God decides to do something and he can't do it. If God fails in doing something, then how is He omnipotent? So actually, Krishna, He is God. He is supreme. But His supremacy does not mean that He takes away people's free will. So by Duryodhana's past karma, He has got a particular kshetra. You know, He has control over the kingdom. He has control over His own body and mind to some extent. And He's functioning in that way. So Krishna goes there to persuade him. And if he doesn't listen, then that misuse of free will have its consequences. But Krishna does not impose. So in that sense, we cannot say that everything that happens is because of Krishna's will. It is because of Krishna's sanction. If Krishna did not allow it to happen, it would not happen. But that does not mean that Krishna wanted it to happen. It is not that Krishna, from within the heart of Dushyasan, gave Dushyasan the idea to dishonor Draupadi. No, Dushyasan, as a prince, by his past karma, had certain power, certain position. And when he decided to use that power and position in a particular way, Krishna allowed him to do that. So when bad things happen in this world, it is not that Krishna is making those bad things happen. Now, there are two different visions of this. I'll explain this. First level is that Krishna is, we have to be very careful in understanding that Krishna is not the cause of our suffering. Krishna is the cure for our suffering. Now, Krishna is not some evil god up there or some apathetic god up there who is just causing sufferings to us. Krishna is right here within us in our own hearts. And he is ready to give us relief if we turn to him in remembrance. So Krishna is the cure for our suffering. He is not the cause of our suffering. The cause of suffering is actually very complicated to understand. I have a whole seminar on karma, destiny and free will. And I won't go into that. But just one point to... We may sometimes... Now for example, there are several natural calamities that happen now. I was in Florida recently when we had this Irma. So a lot of devastation has been caused by this. So now when this such natural calamities happen, now we have to be careful how we explain things. Now in a lighter way, we say hurricane is Hari's cane. Now that is fine to say sometimes say to in a devotee community. But it is not that Krishna is personally, he has an agenda against some Puerto Rico and that's why he destroyed Puerto Rico. It is not like that, you know. Actually, why things happen in the material world, it's very difficult to understand. And we can't simplistically, on karma, we can't give it as a pat answer. You know, when there is suffering, it is on very few, if any, occasions, do scriptural characters say it's because of your karma? The person oneself may say, but others don't say it to that person. When Draupadi is dishonored, nobody tells her it was your karma because of this happened. So, we cannot just use karma as a pat explanation. There's really great suffering in the world and we have to be sensitive to that. So, in the first canto, there is this section where Parikshit Maharaj is going through the forest, going through his kingdom, and he sees a cow and bull being harassed. And he immediately gets on and stops Kali. Seeing him, Kali, that Kshatriya impersonating person, shrinks back. And then there's a conversation that happens between the bull and Parikshit. It's a very peculiar conversation. Parikshit asks, now, what is the cause of your suffering? I say, what are you saw? He's beating me right now. What is the cause of my suffering? If some thief is beating someone and the police come over there, what is the cause of your suffering? Hey, you saw me, he's beating. What is this? And his answer, the bull's answer, is even more peculiar. Actually, he says the cause of suffering is very difficult to assert. Some people say it is because of grahas. Some people say it is just the nature of Prakriti. Some people say it is because of karma. Some people say it is because of destiny. And some people say the cause of suffering can never be understood. And then Parikshit responds by, he appreciates. He says, you are really an enlightened person. And then he makes the most shocking statement of his whole conversation. He says, one who blames the wrongdoer gets the same destination as the wrongdoer. How do you digest this? You know, if A wounds B, and B says A wounded B, if A gets this, A gets the karmic reaction, is B also going to get the same karmic reaction? No, that's not the point. The Bhagavatam is actually guiding our vision to a deeper level of perception. So if you see the driving story of the Bhagavatam is itself Parikshit Maharaj being cursed by Sringi. Now if we look in terms of systems of proper hospitality or whatever, actually speaking, Parikshit, what did he do? He did not do anything very seriously wrong. It's a minor infraction and he was sentenced to death for that. Now the Bhagavatam's whole mood is, just don't look at the immediate cause. Look deeper. The immediate cause is there, but don't focus on that immediate cause. So, in the whole narrative, Parikshit does not blame Sringi at all. Nor does Parikshit blame Shamik Rishi, you know. You did not train your son properly. No, he just accepts it. So yes, there is the immediate cause which needs to be considered at times. And in the particular pastime of the cow and the bull and Kali, Parikshit does consider the immediate cause also, and he punishes Kali. But the point of that conversation is that that whole conversation is trying to take us beyond the immediate cause. So whenever there is suffering, we may look at the immediate cause, but we don't stay at that immediate cause only. Because of you this happened, because of you this happened, because of this this happened. The point when the Bhagavatam finally is saying that, Parikshit Maharaj is saying that those who blame a wrongdoer get the same destination as the wrongdoer. That does not mean literally in terms of karma. It is referring to the level of consciousness. The wrongdoer is committed a crime because he's saying, this person I want to victimize. That person is in material consciousness, seeing only the immediate things. And when the victimizer is blaming, this person is the victimizer. They also have the same level of consciousness. So in that sense, both will stay in the same material level of consciousness. Of course, based on their particular karma, they will get the destination. But both will stay in material consciousness. In the Ishopanishad, there is a similar mood which says, in the one of the verses, Andham tamah pravishanti ye avidyam upasate tato bhuya ivate tamo ya uvidyayamrataha. That those who worship ignorance, they enter into darkness. And those who worship so-called knowledge, they enter into deeper darkness. Now what is this darkness referring to? It refers to the darkness of material existence. It's, they stay on in material existence. So similarly, here, when we talk about Krishna being the cause of everything, the point is, it is in our relationship with Krishna, what is anukul we do. So sometimes, if I am suffering very much, in some situation. Now, depending on my level of faith in Krishna, either I can see that Krishna, Parikshit Maharaj says, it is Krishna who has come as the snake bird. It is Krishna who has come to free me from material attachment. Now, if somebody has that level of faith in Krishna, then they can see it that way. But somebody is very new, they don't have that much faith in God. And you tell them, you know, God is causing this suffering to you. I say, why should I worship such a God? Just go away. So, when devotees see that, and sometimes the Bhagavatam says, it's Krishna who has come as a suffering. That is more an indication that devotee's deep level of Krishna consciousness. That in the suffering, the devotee is seeing the hand of Krishna. For most of us, it is very difficult to see the suffering as manifestation of Krishna. So if we can, if we have that faith, that is good. But if we can't, we can see the suffering, whatever cause it has come, Krishna is there to give me relief from the suffering. If I absorb myself in Krishna, if I take shelter of Krishna, if I remember Krishna, then I can get relief from the suffering. So tomara ichchaya, what it means is, that here, Prabhupada in his personal relationship with Krishna, for him is seeing that ultimately it's Krishna's will that is anukul for his Krishna consciousness. So we have to see how can our consciousness of Krishna be enhanced by thinking that, oh, the suffering has come because of whatever reason, but Krishna is relieving me of suffering, so let me become conscious of Krishna. Then that is one way of being Krishna conscious. Another way could be that, this Krishna has come as the suffering. If you can think like that, that's wonderful. but we can't, then we don't have to necessarily think that this is a lower level. We have to see how best I can serve. We can't artificially go to a higher level of Krishna consciousness. We can't imagine that I'm at a higher level. Now, if I feel pain, I feel pain. I don't have to deny my pain, but I don't have to be driven only by the pain. So here, Prabhupada, the point which I made is here, that Krishna is responsive, we are responsible. That means that Krishna responds to our actions. So how we desire to remember him, how we view him, how we try to connect with him, based on that, he reciprocates with us. So when we have to find out how we can practice bhakti, dadami bhajatam priti purvakam, with affection, with a positive disposition, how we can practice bhakti. It's a whole different subject. But we say, Prabhupada said, you know, the love for me will show by how you cooperate. So we have to work together. Now, even while working together with different people, maybe we may be able to work with different levels of proximity. So we have to find out how best we can practice bhakti. Some devotee's association is anukul for our bhakti. Some devotee's association is not anukul for us. So then we have to find out how best we can serve Krishna. So here Prabhupada's mood of total dependence is, Krishna, you are the doer. You can deliver all of them. So by your will they have come under illusion. By your will they can come out of illusion. So are there, should we take one more? Or are there any questions at this point? Yeah. Maybe we can sing this verse and then you can have a question. Is this one?
Same verse,
yes.
Get the mercy of Krishna. So,
okay.
Why is it not a general principle? And to summarize, why does the concept of special mercy, like Narad Muni gave in that case, why can't it be given to everyone? This case, Nalakuvar and Manigri were not even asking for it, but still they got the special mercy.
Okay, yeah. So, Narad Muni, when he cursed Nalakuvar and Manigri, he also told them that he will remember your mistake while you are in a tree body. So why can't a similar arrangement be done for everyone? If we remember our past mistakes, then we can rectify. Yes, recollection of the past wrongs is often a strong prompt for not repeating those wrongs. Mm-hmm. However, that does not necessarily work like that. Basically, there are two different points over here. One is that when we remember the past mistakes, that may trigger some repentance within us. That may trigger some determination within us. I don't want to repeat this. Mm-hmm. Now when that is happening, what is the purpose? Or what is the motive? We know that ultimately we want to develop love for Krishna. And if I am practicing some bhakti, or I am doing something simply because of the fear of the consequences of the wrongdoing, then that is still, I'm practicing at the level of fear. It's not at the level of love at all. So that may help some people in at least stopping wrongdoing. But that is not necessarily conducive for developing bhakti itself. We see Ajamil's pastime, when Ajamil saw the Vishnudutas, who came to his rescue when the Yamadutas were about to take him. He was very grateful. But it is not that at that time itself he was delivered. After that he strongly atoned for his sins. And then after a severe atonement for many years, then the same Vishnudutas came and took him. That's why when that book was published about Ajamil, it is not called deliverance, it is called second chance. So Arjun, so he was delivered from that danger But then after that, he had to manifest the transformation of his heart. That means that what happens to us shapes our actions, but it doesn't determine our actions. Our actions are determined ultimately by our own free will. And sometimes something may happen and that may prompt one reaction in one person, another reaction in another person. So if the fear of the wrongdoing and the consequence of the wrongdoing, that is what is prompting me to stop. That is okay motive, but that is not a motive of love at all. We need to develop positive love for Krishna. And Nalakur and Manigriva as the trees, Yamarajan trees, it is not that the remembrance of their past wrongs was what got them into the devotional consciousness. It was beholding the pastimes of Krishna while they were in the Maharaj's courtyard. That is what inspired them, infused them with devotion. So ultimately, it is the jiva who has to use his one's free will properly. And certain resources may be helpful. Certain resources may not be helpful. So yes, from our perspective, we may say, if I remember in the past what wrong I had done, you know, it will help me to face life. But it's not really, it doesn't always work like that. Because we see that in the, again, Hiranyakashipu in the Bhagavatam, he says that, he actually gives a whole lecture on how we are not the body, we are the soul, in the 7th canto. And then what is his conclusion? Therefore, I will kill Vishnu. And he says, I will perform austerity and I know it is very difficult to kill Vishnu. And in performing austerity and trying to get power that will be big enough to kill Vishnu, I may even die. But I don't worry. I won't worry because I am the eternal soul. So I will continue the austerity in my next lifetime. And for many lifetimes I will do the austerity till I get enough power to kill Vishnu. So the knowledge of the soul has not led to any devotion at all. In fact, you know, the idea of an afterlife without a spiritual conception of life can actually be very dangerous. No, the jihadis who are ready to die and kill, why are they doing it? It's not they have so much love for Allah. They have some mullahs have interpreted some verse in a particular way from the Quran, not from the Quran, from the hadiths, where they say that every jihadi who dies will get 73 virgins in paradise. And it is for those 73 virgins that they are giving up their lives. So now when they are thinking like this, see, they are believing in an afterlife. But their conception of the afterlife is simply materialistic. So because of that, what happens? They don't get any benefit. They are actually not benefit in the sense that benefit in terms of transformation of their hearts. What has happened is they simply have extended their materialism to the next life. And the knowledge can help. But how it can help, this depends basically on the intention of the person. So knowledge of afterlife without a spiritual conception of life can actually be dangerous. Without a spiritual, it does not have to be dangerous, but it can be dangerous. Similarly, knowledge of past wrongs, it can help. But the point is, it is simply, even if it does it, it inspires us to practice religion at the level of fear. And for some people, it may not even do that. I have written a book on reincarnation, and there I tried to do a study of. I gave many, many cases of people who remembered their past lives. And it's interesting that there are thousands of cases of children who remember their past lives. But practically none of these children have become spiritual. Isn't it? None of them practice spirituality seriously. Like, there are the most dramatic cases. There was one Thomas Andrews, who was the designer of the Titanic, one of the designers. And he sank over there. And then later on, there's a person named William Barnes, who claimed to be reincarnation of Thomas Mantis. And he gave till date the most satisfactory explanation for why the Titanic sank so quickly. So he said that when he had designed the ship, and at that time when he was going to, before the maiden voyage, he tested it. So he had a hammer and he hammered the hull. Boom! A loud resonance came. And he told, there was a black who was the financier, he said, now we have to thicken the hull. Because of this resonance, if something hits the hull, with this resonance we can cause the ship to crack at many places. See, they had thought that metal will be stronger than wood. And metal will not be easily breakable. But what happened when the collision happened was, there's a resonance in the metal. And the ship cracked multiple places. That's why it sank so quickly. And through a computer simulated model, when they did that, it more or less was concluded that his theory explanation is quite one of the best explanations that he has got. And so at least he is convinced, and many other people are convinced, that he, as William Barnes, is the reincarnation of Thomas Andrews. But he says that black, who was the financier, he escaped on a lifeboat and Thomas Andrews sank. And then Black blamed Andrews, saying that he did not design the ship properly. That's why the ship sank. So William Barnes says, he says, the mission of my life is to clear the good name of Thomas Andrews. So even when one knows about a past life, that has not really inspired one to become spiritual. So remembrance of past life or past actions and their consequences is no guarantor of changing of heart. So by nature's arrangement, you know, when we start a new life, it's a new chapter. So we are not burdened by the memories from the past. And in general, there is a cause effect based on this life itself. I do something wrong, some results come up. But sometimes there are certain causes which have results in the future life, some effects which are coming from causes from a future life, from a previous life. But basically each life is like a new chapter. And that's why most of the things that we see in this lifetime, they are based on this lifetime's framework. Does that answer your question?
There is a second part to that question.
Do we have time? We decide that.
Yes, bro.
Okay.
Regarding Narada Muni giving the special mercy, so why we cannot expect that for everyone?
Okay. Okay, so when Narada Muni gives special mercy, why can't we expect that mercy also? See, the very word mercy means you cannot apply any expectation to it. That is the very meaning of the word mercy. So somebody may say, I will enjoy my senses, and like Ajamil at the last moment, I will chant the names of Vishnu. In fact, somebody said, what I will do is, I will enjoy myself, and then when I have had enough enjoyment, I will take a gun, put it on my head. Hare Krishna! Now we cannot cheat Krishna like that. So the point is that, yes, Ajamil is given special mercy, but the mood of the Bhagavatam, as well as the mood of Srila Prabhupada and the purport over there, is that the extraordinary mercy should inspire us to follow the standard process for getting mercy. It is not that everybody starts demanding that same extraordinary mercy. So there, Shukadeva Goswami says, after narrating this pastime, that, you know, if Ajamil chanted unconsciously and just once, and still he was delivered from Yamadutas, if we chant consciously, if we chant regularly, then surely the Lord will deliver us. So it's not that, whenever there are examples of extreme mercy, the point is they reveal the extent of the Lord's mercy. But there is a standard process for gaining mercy. And we are expected to follow the standard process. So the extreme examples should inspire within us the faith in the Lord's mercifulness. And then if I follow the standard process, surely the Lord will have mercy on me. But the extreme examples are never meant to be standardized. If that sort of thing starts happening, then along with mercy, there has to be a principle of justice. And Krishna can subordinate justice for the sake of mercy. But justice is also an important principle in the world. Otherwise, people can misuse it. You know, when Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Bhaktisanjana Thakur were there, at that time, you know, many Vaishnavas would actually do all kinds of sinful activities, and then they would say, by chanting the holy name, everything, all sins are removed. But it was Bhaktivinoda Thakur who pointed out sections from the scripture which say that if we are doing sinful activities, then the holy name will not have its effect. So we need to change our heart. So basically, some devotees, by the Lord's extraordinary mercy, may be given some special facility. But whether the special facility is there or not, the essential point is we need to use our free will to turn from illusion towards Krishna. To the extent we do that, to that extent we advance. Even in the best of facilities, if we don't turn towards Krishna, then what is the use? Duryodhana saw Krishna himself. Duryodhana saw the Vishwarupa of Krishna. And still he did not change his heart. So, as devotees, the mood is never that I should be given this facility, then I will change. You know, that whatever facility I have, with that I try to change. And if I see some special mercy being given to someone, that rather than demanding that exceptional be made the standard, we see the exceptional as a demonstration of the extent of the Lord's mercifulness. And that inspires us to follow the standard process more. Okay? Thank you. Shall we stop? Okay. Yeah, please.
This is in regards to morning's class. If you look at human history, there's always been a lot of wars, especially the World War I. All these wars were fought between two groups. Each one has its own rationalizations. And given the fact that Bhagavad Gita was rendered on the battlefield, and after its rendition, there was a vicious battle that ensued. When is violence justified?
Okay. So when is violence justified? The Bhagavad Gita leads to a war being fought, and we also have had world wars being fought. There are three different points. First is, what is the purpose of the war? Second is, what are the efforts done to resolve things without the war being fought? And what is the consciousness with which the people are fighting the war? So, if we look at the Bhagavad Gita, we see that before that, the Pandavas went to extremes to avoid the war. It is Krishna himself who went as a Shanti Dut. Now, Krishna, even if everybody at that time did not accept him as God, they all knew that he had killed extremely powerful warriors, demons also. So they knew he was a very powerful warrior. And so for Krishna himself to go as a messenger, you know, a messenger, usually a person very reasonably low in the hierarchy goes as a messenger. So for example, say if there is a standoff between India and Pakistan, and then the Indian Prime Minister goes as a messenger at that. Means the intent or the desire for peace is so great that the Prime Minister himself is ready to go. And then if Pakistan tries to arrest the Indian Prime Minister, he's gone there. Very outrage over there, isn't it? So that's what happened over there. So the Pandavas tried everything. Sometimes we say, I tried everything humanly possible. The Pandavas tried everything humanly possible and everything divinely possible. Also, to avoid war. So, the Kauravas left them with no option at all. The Pandavas said, just give us 5 villages. Even they were not ready to agree with that. See, there are different ways in which we may say no also. Sometimes somebody invites us for some program, some event. And we say, yeah, I would like to come, but I can't come because I have this. So, sometimes we can say no to a particular request without saying no to the person. But Duryodhana, what did he say? I will not give enough land to put the tip of a needle through. this is not just no to the proposal. This is a no to the person. It's an insult. It's so he had no desire for a peaceful settlement. So that's the, if you look at the efforts that were done to avoid the war, they were enormous from the Pandava side. And beyond that also, if you see the purpose of the war, the purpose was there a series of atrocities that the Kauravas performed on the Pandavas. And the Pandavas tolerated all of it. The Pandavas' purpose was not so much that they wanted to win a kingdom. They wanted the rule of Dharma. They wanted the rule of virtue. And if you look at the consciousness, the Pandavas fought not so much to gain a kingdom. They fought so that they could establish Dharma. They fought so that there could be a rule of virtue. So there is a argument for extreme pacifism, which says war should never be fought. Violence is never the solution. But you know, violence is alone not the solution. But violence is sometimes necessary as a precursor to a solution. Sometimes the United Nations, it sends peacekeeping forces to avoid war. Just see what is the name also? Peacekeeping force. So to avoid violence, you need force. So actually, violence or the threat of violence is a major deterrent. It alone will not stop, but it is a deterrent. And sometimes that is what is required. So you cannot say at A, B, C, these factors, violence is justified. But if you look at the overall context, it is that the Pandavas, they were repeatedly, atrocities were performed against them. They tried to tolerate it all. They were very accommodating and still they were rebuffed. And eventually their purpose was to establish Dharma. So if we look at the overall context, then we do see that this was not just a war which was fought for gaining territory, for getting power and prestige. It was a war fought to establish Dharma. And everybody who is fighting may have their own rationalizations. You know, we are on the side of virtue. We are doing what is right. We are doing what is good. But there are objective criteria by which things can also be observed. So, if we consider World War I, World War II, yes, we could say that both parties were vicious to some extent. But certainly in World War II, we can say that there's one party which was much more vicious. And so the other party had to defend. So we have to recognize that violence is not entirely unavoidable. At the same time, the Bhagavad Gita's message is not a call for violence. The Bhagavad Gita concludes with a call for surrender. And Arjuna gives his assent not by saying I will fight. He will say I will do your will. Karishye vachanam tava. The Bhagavad Gita has been commented by many acharyas. There are hundreds of commentaries written on it. But none of the acharyas have ever written commentaries which were calls for war. Ramanujacharya, Madhvacharya, they lived when say Islam was ruling India. But they did not use the Bhagavad Gita. You have to fight against the Muslims. Nothing like that. So they focus on the essence of the Bhagavad Gita. So the essence of the Bhagavad Gita is a call not for violence, not for silence. It's a call for transcendence. It's a call to raise one's consciousness to the spiritual level. And sometimes that raising to the transcendence can be through violence. Sometimes it can be through silence. Sometimes it can be through something else. The important thing is, the Gita itself is not a book that is calling for violence. If you look at it, I have a whole Gita Daily article on this. If you see, the Gita is spoken just before a war. But there is not a single verse which talks about war strategies. In fact, after the fourth chapter, the only reference to war that comes is in the 11th chapter, where Arjuna is talking, where the Vishwarupa is described. There's a reference in the 8th chapter with the Mamanuspar Yuddhacha. But that is more in a broad context, that fighting is your duty as a Kshatriya. So not that particularly fight this war. In the whole last 6 chapters of the Bhagavad Gita, there is no reference to the war at all. So the point of the Gita is not to inspire somebody to fight a war. The point of the Bhagavad Gita is to inspire us all to act according to dharma. Like Arjuna's question at the start is also not, should I fight or should I not fight? Arjuna's question is, Pruchhami tvam dharma sammuda chetaha. He says, I want to know what is dharma. And Krishna tells, what is dharma? So if the Bhagavad Gita had simply been a call to war, it would not have had so much relevance for thousands of years. It has had relevance because it addresses universal questions of what is the purpose of humanity. How are we to act in this world? Does that answer your question? So thank you very much. Shri Prabhupada ki, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki, Jai Gaur Premanande.
Hare Krishna.
Jai
Prabhupada ki, Jai.